Maine's first case of coronavirus, the latest on the state's response. Governor Janet Mills today announced the state's first presumptive positive case of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. Mills says a woman in her 50s in Androscoggin County tested positive and is quarantined in her home. The governor also announced that she's suspending all non-essential out-of-state travel by state employees for 30 days and recommending postponement of non-essential indoor gatherings of more than 250 people. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on Maine Calling, we'll tell you more about what the state is planning. We'll talk with Dr. Nirav Shah, director of Maine's Center for Disease Control, who joined the governor in announcing the new initiatives, and Dr. Dora Mills of Maine Health. We'll discuss the latest on what's known about how the virus spreads, and of course, we'll answer your questions as well. Maine Calling's next. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. The coronavirus has come to Maine, and the state is stepping up measures to curb its spread. Today, we'll talk with Maine's top public health experts to learn more about what is happening here today. Joining me from our studio in Augusta, where he joined Governor Janet Mills for a press conference about the coronavirus, Dr. Nirav Shah. Director of Maine's Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Here in our Portland studio, Dr. Dora Mills, Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health. And as always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about this first case here in Maine, about getting tested, if you have know someone who's might have the disease, what to do, all kinds of questions coming out, and we're here to answer them as best we can. Email talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Well, welcome both of you to Maine Calling. Dr. Nirav Shah, we'll start with you. A busy day. The state announcing the first presumptive positive case of this coronavirus. What can you tell us about that case?
Well, for the past several weeks now, and since late December of 2019, my team and I at the Maine CDC have been preparing for the possibility that coronavirus, or COVID-19 as it's known, could arrive here in Maine. This morning, we found out that indeed we now have our first presumptive positive case of coronavirus. This is an individual who is in her 50s, who currently lives in Androscoggin County. She is not in the hospital, and we have begun the process of working with her to find out some of the basic and classic questions that we ask in these situations. Our epidemiologists are working with her to try to figure out if she had traveled anywhere, and if she did, where did she travel? Since returning to the United States, with whom might she have been in contact with? After we have some of that information, we can start reaching out to those individual contacts and making sure that if they develop signs and symptoms, they are already known to us. We have been, again, preparing for the possibility of a case of coronavirus here in Maine for quite some time now. And as a result of that intense preparation, I've got a team of over 30, almost 40 people now who are working on coronavirus. As a result of that intense preparation, when we got the word that there was a presumptively positive case, we had a plan laid out and we're ready to move on it.
Can just in terms of terminology so that we're clear, what does presumptive positive mean?
That's a good question. The way that the testing system in the United States is set up for confirmation of cases of coronavirus is that the test is first done, for example, in our case, at the state laboratory here in Augusta. And that's where this test was done, at the Maine CDC's laboratory. But right now, the U.S. CDC asks that state laboratories send those positive samples down to Atlanta for them to just take another look at it and do a double check. So that's why we report this as a presumptive positive. The sample is soon to be on its way to Atlanta, where they will run the test again. Because of the heightened concern around coronavirus, we in the public health community want to make sure that if a test comes back positive, it is really positive. And that's why we do this two-step check process. Soon, that may be removed, and when a lab result at, say, the Maine CDC lab comes back positive, that will be a final. But for right now, we send, in every state, sends all positive tests down to Atlanta for confirmation.
The governor announced today that she's taking a number of steps. One, proclaiming an insurance emergency to improve access to care and also to require private health insurers to cover the costs related to coronavirus testing. Number two, suspending all non-essential out-of-state travel by state employees. And then finally, recommending on the advice of your agency that non-essential large indoor gatherings of 250 attendees or more be postponed in order to delay a potential outbreak. The point of that, though, is I think you have pointed out, is to not necessarily try to isolate or end or prevent a bunch of transmission cases, but to slow the curve. Can you explain why limiting these large groups, why that's important, and what it does for the system?
When we're dealing with an outbreak of something like coronavirus, one of the goals is to use, or one of the goals of managing the outbreak is to what we call flatten the curve. So I ask everyone to imagine two situations, hypothetically. One is a situation where we had a high number of cases in a very short period of time, a lot of cases crunched into a really short period of time. And you could imagine on a graph paper that would be just a high peak in a very short period of time. Now imagine a different scenario where you had the same number of cases, but spread out over a much longer period of time. That curve would be nice and slow and gradual and flat. What we're trying to do in situations like coronavirus, where there's not a vaccine, is to make the curve as flat as possible. Even though that's the same number of cases overall, the strain on the healthcare system is much less. And that means the healthcare system can continue to provide good care for every single patient who comes in the door. The way that we go about flattening that curve, among many, is to use what's called social distancing. Coronavirus is spread through respiratory droplets, coughing, sneezing. So the more space that we can put between one person and another person, the less likelihood there is that the virus will spread, the more that we can disrupt the natural flow of the virus. One of the many ways to do that is by recommending that large gatherings be dispersed or suspended overall. That reduces that close contact that we know can lead to those respiratory droplets going from person to person to person. And that's why Governor Mills made this recommendation to limit, suspend, or postpone any large non-essential gathering in the state for the time being.
I want to bring in Dr. Dora Mills, who we should mention is also the sister of the governor.
And a classmate of yours.
And a classmate.
We are one big small town, aren't we, Keith?
We are one big small town. So this is news, of course, because it's the first case, but from where you sit, it was a matter of time, I'm sure. So what's next? Is it trying to do what the state can do, what individuals can do, what companies can do, what everyone can do to flatten this curve?
Epidemic curve, absolutely. We really are all in this together, and we at Maine Health have been preparing for this for years. And we've been through a number of pandemics and threatened epidemics. H1N1 was only 10 or 11 years ago, and that certainly a lot of people got sick during that. We had a threat of SARS at one time. And we've had very severe influenza seasons. And just about every year, influenza is a major killer. In a mild year, it's a major killer. So we have to put this all in perspective. We've been through a lot of this before, and we go through it to some degree every year. But as Dr. Shaw so well articulated, with this particular virus, we want to be very, very aggressive, and it's going to take all of us working together to flatten that curve. I think we're all becoming epidemiologists here during this, but it is, I liken it to a blizzard. It's like we've got a forecast for a long-lasting blizzard, and we need to think of this as being, we need to hunker down as we do every year or two when we have a major blizzard, but it's going to last longer than a couple of days.
And you see the spectrum of kind of response to this in the general public, even in the Congress, ranging from
I'm not going to stop shaking hands. You know, this will just pass over to, all the way up to this is a serious public health crisis that needs to be dealt with. So how do you, as a public health official, you know, or people in the public eyes and ears, how do you balance that and say, hey, don't panic, but take this seriously? Where should we?
That's right. Well, we all need to be paying attention. We all need to be staying informed. We will get through this. We'll get through it together. It is going to take a full effort. And I think one of the reasons why Dr. Shaw and I and many, many other of our colleagues around the country are really, you know, taking notice and with this is that we saw what happened in China, and then we saw what happened in South Korea, and then we saw what happened in Italy. You know, they, in a span of 2 weeks, went from about three cases to shutting down the entire country. We've also seen this epidemic expand very rapidly in the Northwest and up and down now, I think the West Coast. And we've had now expansion in Boston area as well as in New York. It was a conference that people might have heard about. The Biogen company had a meeting at the end of February, 175 or so attendees, I understand. The last I saw, they had 77 cases from that one meeting. That was just in Massachusetts cases, and they had a number of others who came from other states and other countries who went home and became positive. So we've seen some of these, you know, the ability of this virus to expand pretty rapidly. So we're taking this very seriously, and just we don't want people to panic, but we also want them to make plans to be able to stay home like a blizzard, you know, be able to work from home if you can, to be able to prepare for kids being home from school or daycare. And if you're particularly, I want to emphasize, if you're in a high-risk category, over 50 for severe disease, over 50, but the older you are, the more severe this can be. So over 70, particularly, and especially over 80. Or if you have any serious medical condition, serious medical chronic condition, you really need to be very vigilant and, you know, stay at home as much as you can. I've got my kids volunteering to take to get groceries for people, our neighbors who are older neighbors. And because I told them, I don't want you going out to the grocery store.
Seems a lot has changed even in the last 24 hours around the entire globe. But what do we know about you and you were mentioning the flu? This is much more possibly more contagious than the flu. What do we know about how long, for example, it can survive in the air or even on surfaces?
Well, I think that the biggest difference, I'll say right now, is that with flu, we always have some of us with immunity to it. Even in with an H1N1, you're going to have some people who, for some reason, they've got some immunity. We also have antiviral medications, and we have vaccine. So with this particular virus, we don't have any known immunity, although with some reason it's sparing children, so we don't know what that's about. We don't have medications that we know to be effective, though some are being tried, and it's going to be a little while before we get a vaccine. So the tools we have are very different. So that's, I think, to me, the major differences between influenza and this novel coronavirus. There are, you know, epidemiological studies that are underway, and you hear the case fatality rates vary between a little less than 1% to 4.5%, and it's several in between, whereas seasonal influenza is usually 0.1. But again, that's we have medications, we have vaccine, and we have some immunity to it. So of course, the case fatality rate is going to be less, much less. So it varies, and we know the fatality rate goes up with age, especially and with those with chronic serious conditions. So that's, you know, those are the major differences, and it does seem to be quite contagious, maybe more contagious than influenza, not as contagious as measles or chickenpox, but it does seem to be, you know, relatively contagious. Although Dr. Shaw, I know you're on the line, and he's got kind of a direct line to the U.S. Yeah. CDC and Dr. Fauci, so he may want to chime in.
Yeah, I was going to ask the same question of you, Dr. Shaw.
Dr. Mills is exactly right. The new coronavirus, or COVID-19, it's concerning. Dr. Mills is correct. One of the concerns that we have with any new virus like this is that it hits a population of people that don't have immunity to it. But on the other parameters that we look at, whether it's how lethal or how transmissible it is, how easily it can spread from person to person, the news with coronavirus is not good. Now, in the spirit of trying to be a little bit more optimistic, based on some of the early data that have come out of other countries, One of the good pieces of news is that approximately 80% of people who acquire the virus have mild symptoms that may resolve on their own. However, that still leaves a large fraction of people, 20% of people, who don't fare so well. If my mother were in that 20%, I would be extremely worried. But what's also important is that we all have a role to play here. Given that we know that coronavirus is in our country, in our state, every one of us has something we can do. For some of us, it might just be fist bumps rather than handshakes. For others of us, it might mean foregoing large gatherings for a while. For others, like Dr. Mills said, it might mean looking after our neighbors more and making sure that they've got groceries and medications. There's something for each and every one of us here to do. For me personally, knowing that there's something that I can do to learn more about this virus and get my head around how I can help people in my own community, my family, my neighbors, that actually helps put me at ease. Even though there's scary things going on, my message to folks is don't panic, but do plan. And plan to help your own family, help your own self, but help everyone around you. My message really, honestly, to everyone is be kind to one another and take care of your neighbors.
There are concerns, I'm guessing, around whether the curve is not flattened enough and the hospitals and healthcare system in Maine is overwhelmed, as mentioned in Italy. Are the state's hospitals prepared? Do they have enough respirators? Do they have enough tests? Are they equipped to handle a serious outbreak?
You asking?
I'll ask either of you. But
well, I could say that
I'll let Dr. Mills start. Yeah.
Well, we you know, as I mentioned, we have been preparing this for this for years, and Maine Health, Central Maine Healthcare, Northern Light Health, Maine General, all of our healthcare systems and hospitals have been preparing and for many years for this, and we've gone through a lot of drills. We've had very severe flu seasons where we've had to cancel routine surgeries, non-essential surgeries, and have people stay home rather than coming into the doctor's office for just a physical. So we've been through this before. This may be more severe than that. So that's why we're really gearing up. I mean, at Maine Health, all of our hospitals have been standing up their committees, the pandemic flu committees, for some time, and they've been preparing. We're looking at our pandemic flu stockpile because it's the same equipment. So we've been preparing. We are prepared. This could still be a strain. It could be a strain. It's a strain in Seattle right now. But that's why we are fortunate in Maine to have this probably increasingly narrow window. We have Seattle didn't get any warning. We have the warning of Seattle. We got the warning of New York and Boston, Italy. So we now have our first case, another warning. So we have this narrow window now to really hunker down, and that's going to take all of us cooperating and being very, very vigilant around social distancing and respiratory hygiene, what we call the non-pharmaceutical interventions, social distancing and respiratory hygiene. Those are extremely important. And those towns, we know from the 1918 pandemic flu, that those communities that really hunkered down with those strategies fared much better than those who didn't. So now is the time. So if you are in those high-risk populations, stay home, get stocked up, have your neighbors and family help you. And then if you're not in those categories, please try to help out those neighbors. And also, we should all just get used to hunkering down. I've told my own kids, it's going to be a little different for a while. We're going to end up playing a lot of cards and board games and things like that at home. And thankfully for the internet, we've got a little, other things to do, too. So we're, they're going to be a little bit, life is going to be a little bit different for a while.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you, your questions and comments. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. DeadRiver.com. Maine Humanities Council, using books and big ideas to foster discussion about Maine's past, present, and future. MaineHumanities.org. And Bowdoin College, presenting lectures, performances, and other events, an average of more than 100 each month, that are free and open to the public.
You are being watched all the time from space by a spy agency that most of you have never heard of.
Most people understand that some of their information is being monitored, and we just have to recognize that there's an ability to observe more from space than ever before.
That, plus the latest on the coronavirus outbreak, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. Perhaps you listen to All Things Considered on your way home or while preparing the evening meal. Might we suggest, after you settle in a bit later, that you watch the PBS NewsHour on Maine Public Television to sift through the day's important stories and developments? Available at both 6 and 7 weekday evenings, the program is known for its thoroughness, fairness, and impartiality. And it's commercial-free, as you'd expect from public media, a news source you can trust. The PBS NewsHour at 6 and 7 each evening on Maine Public Television.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the latest on efforts to slow the spread of the new coronavirus, which has arrived in Maine. My guests today are Dr. Dora Mills, Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health, Dr. Nirav Shah, Director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and we invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us now on the line is Elizabeth McClellan. She's the founder and president of Partners for World Health. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Oh, delighted to call in.
Tell us a little bit about what your organization does and how it's helping to address this pandemic.
We're the organization here in New England that collects all sorts of discarded medical supplies and equipment from a variety of hospitals, nursing homes, and local individuals here in Maine, but also in New Hampshire, Vermont, and Massachusetts. We're the only organization that does this in New England. And then we repackage and reprocess all of these supplies and ship them in containers to Africa, Asia, and the Middle East to hospitals in need.
So how can people help? Anyone's listening here, how can they help your mission?
Well, we're always looking for volunteers, and of course, as you know, many of the challenges that with coronavirus has created closings of schools where these colleges are sending students home, you know, for till the end of the semester, and that actually is going to be a major impact on us because our volunteer pool is largely made up of college students who come in here during the week as part of their coursework, doing community service, or on a Saturday to volunteer and help to sort through all of our medical supplies. So a big thing that we really need would be a greater number of volunteers that might be interested in helping us out.
And they just reach you via your website? Is that Partners for World Health?
Yes, we have an application, volunteer application online through partnersforworldhealth.org. And then they fill out the application, and then they come in for an orientation, and then we'll sign up for coming back in to volunteer. We welcome anyone who's interested in coming. We have a variety of different work groups that come and universities in the past, and I'm sure all of that, once coronavirus has passed us by in several more months, that the students will be back. But we definitely are losing a big source of our workers and our people that help us out.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it. Elizabeth McClellan, president of Partners for World Health. Dr. Mills, you're mentioning the closure of colleges here after spring break. Bowdoin College,
our alma mater,
University of Maine system also. Are those, in your view, sort of appropriate steps for these institutions to take?
Yes. You know, I actually talked to President Clayton Rose several days ago, and it just seems so prudent. You know, the situation that Bowdoin found itself in is that spring break started a week ago. And so about 1,800 students took off for all parts of the country and some even abroad. And so he found himself with things changing so rapidly that, you know, obviously if it was if spring break started tomorrow, he might have just kept them on campus. But they spread out all over the country, and then you can't then in 2 weeks bring them back without expecting that you're going to have COVID-19 on campus. And so how do you isolate? How do you protect the community? I mean, it just got to be logistically so hard.
Let's go to Brunswick now, and we'll go to the phones. And Beth joins us. Hi, Beth. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My husband and I spent a week out in Colorado with extended family and came home with pretty bad colds. Of note is that one of the people we were with for a week had arrived from Switzerland. He came down with a cold. Two other adults in the household came down with colds and recovered quickly. So my husband and I are on the tail end of this. How does my primary care doctor decide if I should get tested?
Dora, do you want to start?
That's a great question. And actually, the criteria for whom should get tested is changing, is evolving every day. So, a week ago, it was very, very narrow. People who had a known exposure to somebody with COVID-19 or somebody who traveled from just certain countries and with symptoms. Now it's evolving. So it's if you've got symptoms and you've traveled or if you've, had a known exposure, for sure. And then, in your case, I'm looking up Colorado quickly to see if they've got community spread or they've got some cases. So I think that's going to be an individual decision. And certainly if you are in a risk group, there are, you would want to have a lower threshold for testing. So I'm not here to give medical advice, but I would definitely call your provider and get some advice and see, if there's community spread in the places where you visited, if you were in a high risk group. There are different epidemiological and demographic factors that should be considered, but not everybody necessarily with a cold needs to be tested, but there are, you have to weigh all the different factors.
A lot of people use the emergency room as their go-to. In this case,
Thank you so much, Keith, for reminding me of that. Absolutely. We are asking that if you feel like you need to be tested, to please call your primary care provider. 211 is set up. The Maine state government has set that up. We do want people to call. So we want to make sure that you get the care you need, but we're also not spreading the infection too. So we want to make sure to keep people who are symptomatic going to places where they can get tested, but they're not going to be around other patients who may not have the infection. And I should just say my kudos to Dr. Shaw and the Maine CDC. They have got the test kit from the federal government just a few days ago, and they've been really ramping up and testing quite a bit. So thank you, Dr. Shaw, and all the staff at the Health and Environmental Testing Lab at Maine CDC. I know they're working on overdrive trying to process these tests and get the results into people's hands as soon as possible.
Dr. Shaw, how accurate are the tests?
They're quite accurate. The way that the test works is that it takes a sample of the patient's nasal passages or the back of their throat and extracts the virus from that, if it exists. And then it looks at the DNA, or in this case, the RNA, the genes of that virus, and compares it against the known genes of the virus that are out there. And so it looks to see in different parts of that code whether there's a matchup. And if it finds one, we have extremely high confidence in the test and the result. And by converse, if it doesn't find anything, we also have a lot of confidence in the negative result. But what's really critical about testing for things like this is not knowing whether the test is good or not, but really trying to figure out when the test should be administered. Because in order for someone to have enough of the virus in their body to be able to be detected, one of the things that we know as a general rule is that they probably need to be showing symptoms. The virus replicates, it multiplies in the body. And one of the byproducts of that is the virus causes symptoms. And so if we test people when they don't have symptoms and they come back negative, we don't really know whether that's because they never had the virus in the body in the first place, or we just didn't test them at the right time. So that if we had waited a couple more days until they had symptoms, then maybe we would have found it. So the art here is partly about having a good test, but also about knowing when it should be used.
Let's go to June in Aroostook. Hi, June. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Yes, I've been sick since February 28th, and I went to the ER last week, and my primary care referred me and tested negative for both flu tests, but they wouldn't test me for COVID-19 because they said that was for advanced lung cases, and I have serious underlying conditions, and I'm just really hoping that Maine can start really bringing in a lot of testing and, you know, not do the don't test, don't tell, and especially in economically depressed areas, because in my area, all this winter, there's the past, you know, couple months especially, there's been a lot of coughing. I even had my neighbor pass away from respiratory, and they didn't even know what or why it was happening. And I've talked to a lot of people about this, and they said, oh, yeah, you probably have this thing that's not a flu, but she said a lot of people have it. I just heard this last night, and I'm like, I have heard a lot of coughing up here. So I do hope that, in especially in the economically depressed areas around the country, that they don't do a don't test, don't tell, and share that. And, yeah, there's just been an awful lot of coughing and deaths, and I'm wondering if a lot of the things that, you know, the complications people have been having are perhaps from just undiagnosed COVID-19. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Dora, do you want to?
Sure. And I would actually turn over to Dr. Shah. I think you have tested 60-some-odd tests, and as the tests ramp up, there will be more testing done. I know Dr. Shah, the Maine CDC, just received the test kits just a few days ago. And of course, without the criteria have evolved. So even just a few days ago, it was really had pretty strict criteria as to who should get tested. And it's now expanding. So Dr. Shah, you probably have some thoughts on that.
Dr. Mills is exactly right. The test criteria that are set by the U.S. CDC, not by the state of Maine, but by the U.S. CDC, have changed really dramatically and quickly just in the past several days. Where they stand right now, today, is that an individual can be tested if they have symptoms and their doctor thinks they need to be tested. If both of those criteria are met, which really means that the doctor is now the gatekeeper of when a patient should be tested. Once the doctor determines, yep, this patient has symptoms and I believe that it's possible or probable that they have COVID-19, all the doctor needs to do is to alert the Maine CDC laboratory, and we are standing by to do the test. We are significantly ramping up the number of tests we do. That's because more and more doctors are testing now. So we're hoping that that continues. One of our messages to physicians across the state is to think about the possibility of COVID-19 now that the testing guidelines have been liberalized and more people are considered eligible for testing.
Lynn writes in, we've been hearing a lot about how to avoid infection, but what if we are caring for someone who is infected with COVID-19? What do we do? Do we give them Tylenol, ibuprofen? What's the course of care?
So it's an excellent question, and the U.S. CDC has a great fact sheet that you can find online. I think if you Google CDC coronavirus, I forgot the title of it, it's taking home or taking care of people at home with coronavirus or something like that. But they basically say there's a couple of things you need to do. One is obviously make sure that they're okay. And again, most people do fine, just like with a really a bad cold, bad respiratory infection. So it is, you know, making sure that they have fluids, they're breathing okay, and that they, some anti-fever medications on hand, and so on and so forth, as you would do with somebody with influenza or, you know, a bad respiratory infection. And then second of all, you need to protect yourself and make sure you don't get it. So you have to look at the situation you're living in. If you have a shared bathroom, for instance, you want to each keep your toiletries separate. You want to separate where you're sleeping, for one thing. And then so if somebody's on the couch and somebody's in the bedroom, keep your toiletries with you. And then when you go to the bathroom, take your toiletries in with you, including the towel. So you don't have any chance of, you know, picking up somebody else's towel, those kinds of things. So that kind of social distancing and respiratory hygiene, but applied inside a home.
And so should you also stay home?
Yes, absolutely. You should both stay home. And so, because, of course, if you're caring for somebody, you're now exposed. So you want to be careful. And both of you just need to be able to stay home, or however many people. So there are some directions on Maine CDC's website, U.S. CDC's website. And I know at Maine Health, we have gotten those out to providers so they can hand those out.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about people have questions about travel and meetings, both important parts of our lives. Well, we'll touch on that. and your questions and comments as well. The number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bar Harbor Savings and Loan, committed to providing competitive rates to all their loan and deposit customers. Your community bank since 1902. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On March 12, 1993, a large cyclonic storm formed over the Gulf of Mexico that would ultimately result in the Great Blizzard of 1993. The blizzard was classified as a Category 5 storm and was one of the most devastating storms of the 20th century. It was unique for its intensity and massive size. At its height, the storm stretched from Canada to Honduras. Portland witnessed 26 inches of snow and Caribou 17 before the storm dissipated over the Atlantic Ocean.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of DN Wealth Advisors and the Maine Seacoast Mission. Happy birthday, Maine!
Hello, I'm Philip Young, host of World Affairs. As the COVID-19 virus continues to spread, governments around the world are scrambling to contain it. Next on World Affairs, we talk with Larry Brilliant, a renowned epidemiologist, and Lori Garrett. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning global health journalist. And we untangle alarming stories from China, Iran, and Italy.
That's coming up later today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the latest on COVID-19, which has arrived in Maine. We're talking with Dr. Nirav Shah with Maine Center for Disease Control and Dr. Dora Mills with Maine Health. Join the conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. And a programming note, this evening at 7, Maine Public Radio will air Governor Janet Mills' press conference from earlier today on what the state is doing to address the coronavirus here in the state. We're getting some questions about living our lives amidst this new reality, including meetings and travel. We're going to go to Brunswick and take a call from Craig. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, a compliment to Dr. Mills and Dr. Shah. You and other public health officials that I've been learning from are remarkably consistent in your advice. I'm just really appreciating that. We're not hearing such consistency from other people, but among public health officials, it's great. I'm a professional meeting facilitator, and I know that lots of people, probably hundreds and thousands of people, are trying to decide, should I have my meeting or not? I know you've advised against large gatherings, but what about the meeting of 10 to 40 people? Should we go ahead with those or not?
That's a great question. Is that Craig? Is that Craig Freshly, I bet?
Yeah, hi, Dora.
Hi, Craig. You know, we really are one big small town, and thank you so much for the compliment. I know Dr. Nirav Shah and I appreciate it a great deal, but yes, Craig, you run the good groups, gatherings or something, and it's a great group that you run. And I was thinking about you actually the other day and realizing there are you and many, many other industries, companies are going to be affected by this. I mean, I just walked down Congress Street recently and the restaurants were already seemed to me noticeably less crowded. And so I think this is going to be a lot of impact on many different industries. And we also have to think about those people for whom their jobs, may affect in a negative way. So, yes, Craig, I think I got an email from I'm on your email list, and I think you are thinking about doing online meetings. And we are at Maine Health. We have actually used an online meeting platform, the Zoom technology. I think there's many others available too, and Skype and others. We've used that for some time, and we are ramping that up because it's always been nice to bring people from across our 11 hospitals across Maine Health and to come together at our corporate headquarters in Portland. But we're realizing in this day and age with this pandemic and with climate change, frankly, as well, we need to do a lot more online meetings. And we can see each other now on the computers, so there's no reason why we can't move many of our meetings to online. And we indeed started doing that recently in light of the coronavirus.
What about travel? Does it depend on whether you're over 60? Does it depend on whether you're going to a place that's a hotspot? I mean, what is the equation here?
So that's the most common question I'm getting from, you know, Maine Health employees is now we have also asked that people not do work-related travel out of state, conferences and that kind of thing. So, but what I am getting a lot of questions around, well, gee, I have a personal trip. I'm going to, you know, New York for the weekend, and can I still go? So it's, you know, there's a big gray area in there, but the most, what's not gray is that if you are in a high-risk group, you should not be getting on a plane and traveling, in my opinion. And I think CDC, Maine CDC and US CDC is saying something very similar. So if you are over 50, but the more you're over 50, so particularly over 70 and over 80, you should not be traveling. And if you've got an underlying medical condition, you should not be traveling. You should just hunker down. Pretend it's a blizzard, a nor'easter. If you are a healthy 30-year-old, and you want to go someplace for the weekend, you want to fly to New York or something, I think you've got to look at a lot of factors, including not only your risk factors, which if you're a healthy 30-year-old, you probably have less risk of having severe disease, but you have to think about where you're going and look up the data. You could pretty easily find out online where the coronavirus is spreading, and it's because the United States has just started testing in a much bigger way. There may be a place you're going to you think that doesn't have any, and then it turns out it does. So you have to figure out that, you know, what the epidemiology is and where you're going. You also have to think about the risk of you contracting it and bringing it back. You know, we are the oldest state in the country, and I really would hesitate for a 30-year-old to go someplace where there's known coronavirus and come back and bring it back to Maine. So I think we have to think there's a lot of factors that you have to think about, and what is the event. A lot of places, if you're going someplace for a wedding, a lot of them are being postponed right now as we speak. So a lot of factors. And I think I also actually realized that Craig Freshley's question about how many people in a meeting, because obviously a meeting is usually, you know, 30, 40 people and not 250. And should they be postponed or canceled? You know, we're basically at Maine Health. We're using the criteria. If we can do it online, we're doing it online. Yeah. And honestly, most meetings we can do online.
All right, let's go to Bev in Camden. Hi, Bev. Welcome to the program.
Hi. We need to stop the panic and pray. The problem here is that the politicians are not God, and the National Guard could be dispersed with all their trucks that are just sitting there with masks. We can't get any masks. Tylenol in the back of the Lysol can says kills coronavirus. Why doesn't everyone in Maine have a can of Lysol? And if you should start coming down with symptoms, elderberry and grapefruit seed extract will fight the coronavirus.
All right, Bev. I bet Dora's going to challenge you on that. But
yeah, I mean, I think I don't know if there's any evidence about the latter claim, but yeah, I actually went to – I, of course, missed going to the grocery store when there was a big rush to stockpile. So I managed to go Sunday evening and found most everything I wanted, which was reassuring. But toilet paper and paper towels, but did not find Lysol, did not find rubbing alcohol, didn't find bleach, and didn't find hand sanitizer. So, those are all effective. So the good news, there has been some studies came out just a few days ago that show that actually isopropyl alcohol, rubbing alcohol, bleach, those are all those common disinfectants are effective against coronavirus and preliminary data. But hand washing, you know, this coronavirus has a lipid envelope. So around it, so a lipid's a type of fat. You know, you've got grease on your hands. You want to get soap and water on it, right? Because it gets rid of grease, which is a type of fat. So by the same token, I think, you know, hand washing should be very effective against coronavirus. Because again, it has that fatty coat to it. So it more easily, you can get rid of it off your hands with soap and water. So if you're like me and I didn't get a lot of hand sanitizer before it went off the shelves, it's okay. You got to sink in soap.
It was mentioned earlier, someone mentioned, in a couple of months, you know, this will be gone by. Dr. Shah, is there kind of an arc to one of these pandemics? In other words, is it 2 months? Is it three? Is it weather related? What can we say about that?
Well, I'll kind of start with the end and then move to the beginning of the question. There has been a lot of speculation and questioning about to what extent coronavirus transmission might be affected by the weather. It's a good scientific question. And like all scientific questions, we will have to wait and see until all the data are in. There are some reasons to think it might be weather related, but there are also reasons to think it might not be. And probably not. In fact, the fact that it's circulating pretty widely in parts of the world right now that are hot and humid, like Singapore and Malaysia, suggests that this hope that it's weather-related may not be what we want it to be. Now, in terms of where this goes, the thing with epidemics, the thing with outbreaks is, like the old saying goes, each one is different. And when you've seen one, you've seen one. That's what makes each outbreak different and why scientists study them so intently. Well, what we know right now is that there are positive signs on the horizon. For example, the number of new cases in China has fallen to just the low double digits now on a daily basis. That does not even for a second undercut the fact that there was significant morbidity and mortality as a result of this in China. What it does suggest is that when social distancing measures are implemented, which is what our scientific textbooks tell us, the results are there. How long that takes to be effectuated in the United States to result in that same decrease in cases, that's something we're going to have to see. It's all the more reason, though, that we underscore the fact that large gatherings probably ought to be suspended. And as Dr. Mills said, we might need to start preparing for a time when we spend more time indoors rather than in large groups.
Let's go to Ben in Swanville. Hi, Ben.
Hello. How are you guys doing today?
Good, thanks. You're on the air.
Great. Super good to hear this. I appreciate all the information that coming out. I'm a firefighter paramedic. I work full-time. I'll call it the Capital Area Department, and I also volunteer out in my rural mid-coast area as a firefighter and a paramedic. And what I'm most concerned about is, you know, upholding our oath, which is doing no harm. And the last thing I want to do is see our first responders, you know, spreading this around. I know in Washington State, they've got a bunch of guys quarantined right now. And some of those larger departments, maybe they can handle that. I really worry that if we have an entire shift of ours quarantined, that means we've got to make that up somehow. We just don't have the people to do that, particularly out in the rural areas. And I'm just looking for some guidance. I know I've heard actually next shift we've got some good training headed our way, but just would love to hear what your guys' thoughts are on that and what we can do as first responders and the folks at the emergency room, what we can do. Because right now we're almost overloaded as it is, and we aren't dealing with coronavirus. So you add this to the top, I really, you know, want to hear what we can do to help these people out, but make sure we're able to do our jobs and keep ourselves and everybody else safe.
Okay, Ben, thank you. Dora?
Yes, and Ben, thank you so much for your service, first and foremost. I know you people on the front lines, you guys are on the front lines, first responders, firefighters, and like you, your jobs are amazing, and you have amazing dedication to your community, so thank you. Yes, you're right. I think at Maine Health, we have two EMS services, so we've been working with them to make sure, I mean, our first priorities is to take care of patients. Our next priority is to make sure our healthcare workers are safe, and first responders are included in that. So there is guidance, and it's evolving, but there's guidance on US CDC's website for if you are a healthcare worker, which, you know, first responders are considered in this case with EMS, and you've been exposed, you think you've been exposed to somebody with COVID-19, then there is guidance about how you can then continue to work, but do active monitoring, for instance. Now, this guidance changes, so don't take my word for it right now, but at least the guidance as of last night was that, and we've had some people who've exposed to potential people who might have had COVID who turned out not to have it, but the guidance is if you're not sick yourself, then you can continue to work if you're exposed, but you have to do active monitoring of your temperature, of your symptoms, and then you get tested and obviously go off work. But that's that guidance will be evolving, and we definitely want to do everything we can to make sure that you have the equipment you need to protect yourself so that you can take care of patients.
All right, let's go to Ben. Thank you. Let's go to Donna in Eagle Lake. Hi, Donna. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. So my situation is I'm 59 years old. I have an enlarged heart, a mitral valve problem, and asthma. I work in a middle school. I don't think I should be going to work, personally. And my question is, should I be working and should I get the bacterial pneumonia vaccine? Because I hear that that's a risk. Patients recover from the virus and then get a secondary infection.
Yeah, Dora, I'm not sure you can comment specifically on her case,
right.
but talk generally about people like Donna.
Absolutely. And excuse me. And thank you for your service as a school teacher. Yes, you should talk to your healthcare provider about what you should do. You know, it has to all the guidance has to be tailored to the individual situation. I'm a big proponent of vaccines, and I would also recommend that you get as caught up on your vaccines as possible. So I would get caught up on your vaccines and talk to your healthcare provider, your doctor, about what you should do given your individual history and your work.
All right, Donna. Thank you. Dr. Shaw, also, in all of this, the recommendation to get flu shots, but to be clear, of course, the flu shot does nothing for COVID-19, but it eliminates just something else to worry about in the health mix. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. And that is correct. And in addition to reducing your chances of getting the flu, which is just in and of itself a great thing, what getting the flu shot can do is to help, again, reduce the amount of strain that the healthcare system is facing at any one time. One of the things that we know is that the healthcare system across the country is operating at high capacity levels. And when additional situations are added to that, like coronavirus, the system's ability to care for everybody may get compromised. And that's a risk. And we want to make sure that everybody who is ill can get into the healthcare system. By getting the flu shot, what you do is reduce your likelihood of getting the flu and particularly reduce your likelihood of needing to be hospitalized with the flu. By keeping you out of the healthcare system, if we have a large swell of coronavirus cases, we can keep those beds free for individuals with coronavirus and keep the folks who may have been exposed to the flu safe because they got their vaccine. Really, getting the flu shot's one of the best things you can do at any time to keep you and your family safe. It is still not too late to get the flu shot. So if you haven't done so, I urge everyone to do so straight away.
10 seconds left. Dora, best place to get information is the CDC.
Yes, Maine CDC and US CDC's websites are fantastic. On Maine Health, we have a website as well that has information, but definitely US CDC and Maine CDC are kept up to date with all the newest surveillance data and the like.
And for more on the situation in Maine this evening at 7, Maine Public Radio will air Governor Janet Mills' press conference from earlier today on what the state is doing to address coronavirus. Dora Mills, Nirav Shah, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. My pleasure.
Dr. Dora Mills, Chief Health and Improvement Officer for Maine Health, and Dr. Nirav Shah, Director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.